for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's 6 minutes after the hour, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and AirAmericaRadio.com as well, along with... there's another one I'm missing in there. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 1-866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, already well populated with some of the finest minds in the entire planet, go to TomHartman.com and click the live chat link, and it'll get you in there. The folks from Votergate.tv, check it out, Votergate.tv, an incredible documentary in the making. Are hanging out here. We've got studio lights and cameras and hey there and all sorts of magic stuff going on. And we're going to have several guests over the next 3 hours of the program. Bev Harris is going to be with us. Andrew Gumbel is going to be with us. We're going to have Brad Friedman is going to be with us. We're going to be talking a whole lot about voting issues, particularly in the second and third hour of the program. Just as a heads up, let you know about that. And I encourage your calls on the topic, particularly as we get into it. But right now, though, it looks like... And we're still waiting to find out, because Mr. Fitzgerald has not, as far as we can tell from the very latest information, Mr. Fitzgerald has not yet come out and said, okay, here's what happened, here's who did it, all that sort of thing. But it looks like Dick Cheney's got his hand in this thing. Now, you know, there's a lot of folks who are saying, well, let's see, Scooter Libby was protecting Dick Cheney. I had been saying, and I don't know, maybe I'm giving him too much credit, I'd been saying that Dick Cheney was protecting George W. Bush. I mean, keep in mind, the memo about this from the State Department went to Air Force One to Colin Powell. George Bush was on the airplane. And suddenly Scooter Libby and Karl Rove are dialing for dollars. I don't know. We'll find out. The main thing it does, though, is it gives the lie. It just gives the absolute lie to George W. Bush when he was saying, as you recall.
And I don't know. We're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, he didn't have any idea. Well, it turns out that apparently he did have an idea. He might have had a whole lot of ideas. He might have had a whole bunch of ideas. Anyhow, we'll see how that goes as time goes on. In the meantime, we're discovering that the FBI has been doing a little more snooping than the law would provide for. This in the face of changes in the law that provide for enormous amounts of snooping. The FBI has conducted clandestine surveillance. This is from the Washington Post. Clandestine surveillance on some U.S. residents for as long as 18 months at a time without proper paperwork or oversight, according to previously classified documents that were to be released yesterday. In other cases, this is an article by Dan Egan in the Washington Post. In other cases, agents obtained emails after a warrant expired, seized bank accounts without proper authority, conducted improper, unconsented physical searches, according to documents. Now, what's an improper, unconsented physical search? I think that's like B&Es. I'm assuming. And although heavily censored, the Washington Post notes, the documents provide a rare glimpse into the world of domestic spying, which is governed by a secret court and overseen by a presidential board that does not publicize its deliberations. What has happened? What has happened to the whole concept of transparency in government? What has happened to the whole concept of government of, by, and for we the people? I mean, that's the core concept of a democracy. We the people of the United States. We're the ones who are the holders of the rights. We're the ones for whom we created this guy. This government. It didn't fall from outer space one day. It wasn't saying, you know, let's set up a government here and it'll just run everything. No, it's us. Bill Clinton, when he was president, and, you know, as you know, I have a a long list of complaints about Bill Clinton's presidency. But to his credit, one of the things that he did that was marvelous was he tried to open up government. He was declassifying documents like crazy. I mean, just like there was no tomorrow, including a lot of documents about the Kennedy killing, by the way, the Kennedy, you know, the assassination of JFK, a topic about which in a couple of weeks we will be discussing on this program, because in a couple of weeks I'll be having a book coming out on that topic, a little tease there for you, a little information. But in any case, Bill Clinton had been releasing more and more of these documents, letting folks know, or letting us know, that we could see what was going on with our government. George W. Bush comes in and he says, nope, not going to do it. In fact, we're going to make secret everything my daddy did. We're going to make secret everything Ronald Reagan did. We're going to make secret everything Bush did. We're going to make secret everything I did. This is with George W. Bush saying. So we have, you know, very few champions left. I mean, you've got the ACLU out there. You've got the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They're the ones who alerted the Washington Post to all this about that the FBI had been obtaining emails after warrants had expired, had been going through people's bank accounts, all this sort of thing. IPEC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, their general counsel, David Sobel, said, and I quote, "We're seeing what might be the tip of the iceberg at the FBI and across the intelligence community. It indicates that the existing mechanisms do not appear adequate to prevent abuses or to ensure that existing mechanisms can prevent abuses and to ensure the public that abuses that are identified are treated seriously and fixed." So this is serious stuff, really and truly serious stuff. And, you know, it's not just in the United States, by the way. Yes. Time for our Berlusconi alert for the day.
Che bella cosa.
Yes, Silvio Berlusconi. He started out as a small-time businessman, some would say small-time crook. Bought a radio station, bought a TV station, bought another radio station, bought another TV station, bought another radio station, bought another TV station, bought a network, bought a radio network, bought a TV network, bought another radio network, bought another TV network. Pretty soon, he owned bought a couple of newspapers, owned virtually all of the media in Italy. What did he do once he owned virtually all the media in Italy? He ran for office! What a surprise! The guy decides to run for prime minister. And surprise, surprise, he won! Actually, it was, you know, it's a parliamentary system. It was his party that won, and they appointed him prime minister. But in any case, this from The Guardian. The man who aims to oust the Italian prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi, yesterday accused his rival, that is Berlusconi, of trying to cheat and buy his way back into power in the next general election, which is going to happen in about 6 months. Romano Prodi opens the campaign with an unprecedentedly hard-hitting interview. He says he's the former president of the European Commission, by the way. This guy is no slouch. He says Italy's going to be finished if media tycoon Berlusconi is allowed to return to office. Now, Berlusconi, for his part, says that he's the victim of media bias. This is the guy who owns the media. He says the media's out to get him. Actually, there is one piece of the media that Berlusconi doesn't own yet. And that's the Italian equivalent of public broadcasting. The Italian National News Service. Berlusconi doesn't yet own that. And he named 7 comedians whom he accused of using the state-owned network, RAI, to launch satirical attacks on him. Now, the last time Berlusconi publicly identified a series of television personalities who annoyed him, this was 3 years ago, they disappeared from the nation's screens. Berlusconi doesn't like you. You toast. So our Berlusconi alert for the day, Romano Prodi, good on you. Congratulations for taking on Mr. Berlusconi. But isn't it odd that the guy who owns all the TV stations, all the networks, all of everything is saying, there's media bias out there. They're out to get me. Oh, my goodness. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. And I think, frankly, a cautionary tale for the United States. What happens when one man, or institution as the case may be, ends up owning all of the media. And, you know, we get these cons on the program who are saying, well, we need government out of our lives. We need media bias. Consolidation is just fine. Well, we shouldn't have all these unnecessary rules and regulations. That's a Sherman Antitrust Act. What's that? You know, and all this kind of stuff. And the bottom line, very simply, is that in any industry, if you just stop the enforcement of laws against trusts, against monopolies, you're going to have a problem. But in the media in particular, it's particularly dangerous, and we're seeing the example of that in Italy. So we'll see how it plays out. Fascinating times. It's 9:16. It's 16 minutes past the hour. 9 on the West Coast, noon on the East. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We found a better way of making it seem clean. We built an electronic voting machine, and then we sold these suckers nationwide. But we're the only ones who know what's on the inside. You push the buttons and our voting machine keeps track. We made it so it's very easy to hack. Call for a recount, it will probably fail. But our machines don't leave no paper trail.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. Give them a call and say hi. They've got the newest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer, really, for that matter. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, nothing less. Well, actually, you know, we'd just settle for a little democracy. Just a little transparency in government of, by, and for we the people. You know, one of those kind of novel ideas. Seems like a reasonable one to me. The administration actively seeking a new leader for Syria. Now, here's a positively spooky juxtaposition of stories. The first was yesterday on this actually came out of an October 21st State Department briefing from earlier in the week, or from late last week. UN report implicating Syria in the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The Bush administration claims to be seeking diplomatic solutions. Question. This is a State Department briefing. Question. Are you discussing or will you discuss military action that would be presumably against Syria, right? This is a nervous capital. People think this administration resorts to force as a way of solving problems. Mr. Erelli, this is from the State Department, he says, I think the record of this administration is clear and commendable that we seek peaceful, negotiated, diplomatic solutions to problems. That is certainly the course that's been set forth in this issue, and that's where our focus is. However, a week or two earlier, the Financial Times reported, and I quote, the U.S. is actively seeking an alternative who would take over from President Bashar al-Assad, according to sources close to the Bush administration. Washington has consulted its allies in an interagency search coordinated by Stephen Hadley, the president's national security advisor. The U.S. is also said to be considering military strikes on the Syrian border in response to its alleged support for Iraqi insurgents. Now, Hadley isn't the only one. Condi Rice has also said that military options against Syria are, to quote Condi Rice, on the table. Then we come to today's London Times, an article by Philippe Naughton and agencies. Headline, Bush says military action last resort against Syria. The article, President Bush said today that military action was a last resort in dealing with Syria if Damascus refused to cooperate with the United Nations investigation into the murder of Rafik Hariri, the former Lebanese prime minister. Now, the UN is already on this. The UN Security Council is due to be briefed tonight by Detlev Meles, a German prosecutor whose report last week found evidence of high-level Syrian involvement in the bombing that killed Mr. Harari and 20 others in Beirut in February. You know, keep in mind, Syria, or at least the Syrian secret police, but to some extent the Syrian army as well, have been, now they would say, keeping the order and keeping the peace. Others would say, you know, controlling the country of Lebanon for some time now. On a visit to Canada, the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urged Syria to drop its, what she called, nonchalant attitude about the report's findings. And John Bolton, Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, demands that Syria cooperates with the investigation. They even note, although Russia, which has close ties to Syria, has warned about the risk of destabilizing the Middle East, Washington and Paris quickly joined forces to back Hermelis's report last week after it found evidence of Syrian involvement in the assassination and a lack of cooperation from Damascus. Is Assad digging a hole that he's for himself? I mean, can he be that dumb? Or are the Bushies, as I've been saying for 2 years now on this program, you know, they need a war every 2 years for when there's an election coming, or a big war every 4 years that they can gin up 2 years in advance, like the war in Iraq. They started ginning that thing up in August, September, October of 2002, just in time for November 2002, the elections. And then they, you know, had a nice war going on 2004 over the elections. Do they need another war for 2006? And I've been suggesting yes, and it'll be Syria. Guess what? Here we are. So it seems like we're moving in that direction. Now, that's not to say that the Syrian regime is the world's best regime, but it does raise the question, you know, what's the job of the United States here in the world? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. And Frank in Boston, Massachusetts on the line. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program. Frank, you're live and on the air. Yeah. Listen to your phone, not your radio.
Okay, I'm sorry. It seems like you're, you know, disappointed in the Syrian findings, that you're not very pleased. It seems like it's justifying Bush's agenda in shaking up the entire Middle East.
No, I'm disappointed that Syria would involve itself in assassinating the president of Lebanon, if that's the case. Sure.
But you first of all, you say if that's the case, like there's any doubt. Syria has a 50-year history of being nothing but, you know,
sure. So
tyrants.
here's the question, Frank: is it our job to be policing Syria?
Well, it's not our job.
You know, they're 6,000, they're 8,000 miles away from us.
Right, but, you know, even the French are admitting that if it wasn't for the American presence in Iraq...
Yeah, Frank, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Just a push of a button, just a touch of a screen. Welcome to the future, come try our voting machine.
Just try them out, my friends.
Voting machine.
Yes, that wonderful technology. Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bev Harris is with us. Bev Harris started up and ran and runs blackboxvoting.org, wrote the book by the same title. And way back, must have been about 3 years ago or thereabouts, Bev, you were working in the trenches, and I was becoming aware of this issue. I wrote an op-ed piece for commondreams.org that got flown all over the Internet talking about you and what you were doing. I know you'd already been out there before that, but it was... I think it was a great revelation for me what you were into, and I'm so pleased to have you on the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and yes, you were one of the original pioneers who actually got it and realized that there was a problem, and I know we communicated very, very early in the game.
Yeah, and in fact, one of our original communications was around whether or not Senator Chuck Hagel's office was going to be putting political pressure, was legal pressure perhaps even, on another publication that was going to out basically Hagel for having been the head of one of the voting machine companies before he ran for the Senate, not disclosing that.
Yes, you know, and what was amazing was here you had a senator whose voting machines for a company that he had a major stake of ownership in were counting his own votes, and his position was this was not a conflict of interest. And I know you and I talked about that back then, and then as that was reported, there was tremendous pressure on both me through a cease and desist order from ESNS and on the publication called The Hill to avoid publishing the information or at least soften it.
Yeah, and we got it out. I thought it was fascinating that here he was, the president of the voting machine company, or one of the senior officers. Wasn't he the president of the company?
He was the CEO up until about 2 weeks before he announced his run for office.
Right, and then he decides to run for the Senate, and this is after the state has basically bought the machines. The whole state is now counting his vote on his machines, and he wins this incredible upset.
Yes, and that was what was, you know, this wasn't something we made up. The Washington Post, out of the entire United States, picked his particular contest in the state of Nebraska as the biggest upset in the United States.
Yeah, in fact, I recall you're telling me that he even won areas where no Republican had ever won before.
Well, they said that he won all the different demographic groups in all the different areas. And, of course, Nebraska is fairly diverse. It has, in Omaha, it has quite a large minority population. And then it's got very rural farming populations. So it is a little bit unusual for somebody to sweep in and grab all those groups, especially since he was such an unknown that he was also considered a huge upset when he won his primary.
Right.
So he actually had two upsets in a row on these machines.
Yeah, and he was running against an incumbent, very popular Democratic governor. This was the point at which, and everybody said I was nuts, you know, this is the point at which I started saying on the radio, and this is years ago,
yeah,
Chuck Hagel is going to be running for president someday. And they go, who?
And exactly.
I said, Chuck Hagel. And they're like, who's that? And I'm like, you know, you just wait. You'll see. You know, when the guy is the head of the voting machine company, keep an eye on him.
Well, and it's true, and I wonder sometimes if maybe we didn't stifle his decision to run for president, because he had announced in January 2003 that he was going to consider seeking a run for the presidency. There's not a lot of talk about that now, but I think at this point there's been so much press on the fact that he was involved in a voting machine company that might be considered unwise for him to do so. If so, that's a good thing, because I think it was clearly unethical that he did not disclose it.
Well, at the same time, I think we have to say every American citizen who's over 35 and a citizen should have the right to run for president. I mean, you know, certainly.
Yeah, it's just a matter of if you have an ethics problem in your background where you didn't disclose your involvement in a voting machine company that counted your votes, perhaps you're not the best qualified.
You spent a lot of time after the 2004 election investigating Florida, Palm Beach County in particular. I'm curious, Bev Harris, in the 2004 presidential election in Palm Beach County, Florida, what did you find?
Well, you know, in Palm Beach, we went at it from this approach. We decided, let's go after the actual logs inside the machines and see what it says happened in those machines. Now, that has the disadvantage that you don't always know whose vote was cast for whom because of privacy issues. But you do get a very good information about what was actually going on inside the voting machine. Did it work or not? And what was interesting is almost immediately we were stymied in our attempt to even get those records. We had to take the supervisor of elections down there, Teresa LaPorte, to court in order to get the records. And when we finally did get the records, which was many months later, we saw why. First, the records showed that the machines did not work properly. And also the records showed that she had been counting votes as early as October 19th for the November 2nd election, which is, of course, illegal.
wait a second. A couple of different things here. Number one, you couldn't just, I mean, government is supposed to be transparent. You couldn't just walk in and say, hey, I'd like to see the records of this election. I mean, after all, it's us. We the people. It's our vote.
Right.
And they said, no, you can't see that.
Exactly. We had to sue her in order to get the records. She was claiming all kinds of things, that they were secret and proprietary and should remain obscure. But, you know, we did prevail, and also it didn't hurt anything that she was replaced and another supervisor of elections was put in her place. And he was much more cooperative. But when we received the records, one of the first things we noticed, one of the voting machine records that comes out is called a poll tape. And what it is like a results tape that comes out at the polling place from the voting machine itself. So you vote on this machine all day. At the end of the day, before they take it away from the polling place, they run a report and it says this machine had this result for the day. Well, unfortunately, some of the results tapes that were run with votes on them, votes that were ultimately counted in the election, but the date and time on the results tape was October 19th.
And the election was on November 2nd, as I recall.
Yes. And there is no way that you can legally count votes, even just a few votes, from a voting machine before the election takes place.
Now, I could visualize or imagine a possible scenario where, you know, they're trying to make sure the machines work, and so they feed a couple of votes through them to see if they work, and the machine tabulates them, and they forget to clean them off, and it's, you know, 5 or 10 votes or something like that. And, you know, it's probably not a big deal. It's a mistake. Is that the sort of thing that you think happened, or was this something other than a mistake?
This was other than a mistake because it happened on multiple machines. And the other thing is we went to look at the final results, and we were able to discern that those votes were counted. In fact, they were the only votes counted for, you know, certain machines in certain precincts. And so they were used in the final result. And if it was just one machine or just two, that might be possibly understandable, although certainly very bad procedure, but it wasn't. There were several machines, and we started finding these early tapes immediately. And then we got into some even more bizarre territory. Of course, after we talked to the people in Palm Beach County, we were told there were no problems. And one of the records we requested was a record that said, okay, give us, you know, your trouble slips. In other words, when there's a problem, you're supposed to log it on a log, and, you know, it should say over in precinct such and such, we had a machine that broke down in the middle of the day. That's going to happen sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Palm Beach County said there were no problems. All right, so we have 600,000 voters, 4,000 voting machines, and they had not a problem at all. Perfect election day. Well, when we got the logs from the machines, and remember, this is a county with about, a little over 500,000 votes, 80,000 times we have cardstuck errors in the machines. And that meaning the machine would simply glitch out in the middle of casting the vote and announce that the card was stuck. That may or may not be a significant problem. There are some issues with that that are a little more technical that make us wonder if the card was even stuck. But we can get to that at some later point. That needs to be replicated. But when you have a county that says we had not a single problem at all, But
then you found 80,000 problems.
80,000 problems.
Yeah.
But then we get into the next more, and I think this is much more serious. These touchscreen machines, and we noticed this across the United States, they had something called calibration problems. Calibration means you push one spot on the screen, and it's supposed to, you know, maybe that's the little box for your candidate, and the check mark is supposed to appear in that candidate, not somewhere else on the screen in some other candidate's box. Well, they always explain this problem by saying the touch screen needed to be recalibrated. It needed to be adjusted so that your touch was registered correctly. And that is a problem because obviously you're not going to recalibrate the touch screen unless for some reason someone is reporting that it's not putting the mark in the right place. Now, they had 4,313 voting machines. 1,475 times these machines were recalibrated during the middle of election day.
What? You mean, in other words, if I touch one part of the screen, say I touch the part that says Al Gore, and it records, hey, thank you for voting for George W. Bush, they have to go in and recalibrate the screen. And this happened how many times on voting day?
Yeah, let's look at these numbers again. 1,475 times out of 4,300 machines.
Wow. Now,
and this is not, I didn't count anything that happened before or before the polls opened. I counted only what happened during the middle of voting.
Now, the $64,000 question here, the phantom votes that appeared on the machines before Election Day that were counted back on the 19th, and these votes, you would expect if these were just errors that they would be entirely randomly distributed. And when we come back from this break, I want to find out what was the consequence of these kinds of errors. We're talking with Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org. She's the founder of Black Box Voting, author of the book by the same title, Bev Harris. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least for democracy. You know, it seems like a good plan, just a little democracy. And democracy, of course, means that our votes have to be counted. They have to be counted appropriately. We're talking with Bev Harris, the founder of blackboxvoting.org. Bev, $64,000 question. You found phantom votes in Palm Beach County, California, Florida, rather, that were on the machines dated October before the November election, yet they got counted in the November election. You found thousands of machines that had to be recalibrated so that when you touched the screen, the right candidate, the name that you touched actually got recorded. I'm wondering if this was just a random error, you would expect that 50% of the time these errors would fall in favor of Bush and 50% of the time they'd fall in favor of Kerry. What happened? What did you discover?
Well, again, because you can't identify who the vote went for on the miscalibrations, it's hard. You have to interpolate that from data. What was interesting is it does appear, and I will want to have some statisticians really crank these numbers to make sure I'm not making any assumptions incorrectly, but it does appear that the recalibrated machines tended to have different results than the ones that were not recalibrated.
Different in what way?
They would tend to favor, in one case, a Democrat rather than the Republican. And that would sort of indicate they were miscalibrated to begin with.
In other words, they fixed them, and all of a sudden the Democrats are doing better.
Yes.
Which means before they were fixed, before they were correctly calibrated, the Republicans were doing disproportionately better.
That's what the data appears to show. Now, there's 4,300 machines, and that is something that I am not a mathematician, but it was a fairly obvious pattern. I mean, it was obvious enough that I could spot it very quickly.
This in Palm Beach County, Florida.
Yes. And the other thing I noticed was in the card stuck errors and those types of errors, those I was able to also see were happening more often in minority areas. They could make a claim, I suppose, the too dumb to vote claim, which I really hate, saying they don't know how to put their card in correctly.
Well, it's just playing on the racism of...
Yes, it is. It's just not acceptable. And by the way, if it was true that a voting machine would disproportionately favor one race over another, then it shouldn't be used. But that was a problem. And, you know, of course, Palm Beach was one issue. And I would have to say that although Florida refused pretty much all the big counties, which there's seven large counties, refused to give up their records in a timely fashion, so all the contest periods had expired by the time we could get their records. The records, as a general rule, do not substantiate the vote. And again, with the computer logs, you can't really tell precisely which candidate should have won, but you can tell if the machine was not functioning correctly.
In other words, you know, setting aside the problems in Ohio, we're not even sure who actually won in Florida in 2004?
No, I don't think we are.
Okay. Now, in addition to Palm Beach County, Florida, you were down in Leon County, Florida, where they use optical scan voting systems, and they were hacked?
Well, here's the problem. We have about 60 counties in Florida, I think 66. 30 of those counties use the Diebold optical scan machine. And it's a particular type of voting machine. They all use essentially the same version. And what there was one supervisor of elections down there who is just an absolutely excellent supervisor of elections. He's very, very careful about getting things right. We had the opportunity to test his system, and he's one of the counties, one of the 30 counties that uses this particular system. And when we tested it, we were able to penetrate it four different ways very quickly. And each of the ways was a very high security risk. We can't find any evidence that any of the election officials in the United States who had this system were warned ahead of time of these problems, or that they were told how to correct for these problems, or that these problems were or were not used, because they leave no trace whatsoever. If you hack a system using the method, the vulnerabilities we found in Leon County, Florida, there will be no trace.
In other words, you actually hacked a system? You were successful in doing that?
Or demonstrating
the hacking of a system?
Demonstrating it, yes. What we did was we loaded in on an election he had actually run. He was a training election. And there were several types of things we did. There was two computer security experts who we worked with. The first one, Dr. Herbert Thompson, he actually was able to penetrate the central tabulator. First, he just typed a few lines of code into the Notepad program. Many of us are familiar with that. Notepad is a little text editor program that comes automatically in all Windows programs.
Right, because these are Windows computers, after all.
Yes, they're Windows computers. And the central tabulator, which is the mothership where all the votes come in at the end of the day, it ran in the background kind of like a virus runs in the background. It would be called probably more accurately a Trojan horse. But you didn't see it at all, but it just went in there and had its way with the votes in the central tabulator, changed them to whatever it wanted. And what was particularly disturbing about that hack was that it was something that could have been implanted in any computer years before. All you would need to know is, you know, on such and such a date, there's going to be a presidential race. One will be a Democrat, one will be a Republican. Go look for the Republican.
Now, did you have to get at this machine in advance, take it down, tear it down, replace hard drives, or is this just a matter of slipping a memory card into it or something like that?
It wasn't even as difficult as that. All we had to do was slip a little, a few lines of text into it. And in the first test, he used the notepad program to create the text and slip that in. The second test, they had taken the notepad program off the computer, thinking that therefore he couldn't get at it. So he used the DOS with DOS edit function and slipped it in.
This is incredible. Bev, I got a couple more questions.
Sure.
We've got a caller who would like to talk to you. Can you stick with us over the top of the news, over the top of the hour for the news, over past the news?
Okay.
Can
yeah,
you
no
hang
problem.
Around with us? Okay, super. We're talking with Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org, her website, one of the real pioneers in this, one of the founders of the whole notion that there might be something wrong with electronic voting, one of the people who's, in my opinion, one of the real heroes of democracy in the United States. Bev Harris with blackboxvoting.com. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, telling the truth that the multinational corporations sometimes would really rather you didn't know all about.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman radio program, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. People's Republic of America, really, it should be. We're talking with Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org. Bev Harris, one of the pioneers in the field of trying to figure out what's going on with these electronic voting machines. Are they safe? Is this a technology that we should be concerned about or we should be celebrating? Bev, excuse me, tell me, what's your take on the security of the machines that measure our paper ballots? For example, here in Oregon, we have vote by mail. Everybody fills in a piece of paper. We mail it in to the Secretary of State. They run it through these optical scanners. How safe are those?
Well, this is very important because the second testing that we did in Florida was by a gentleman from Europe by the name of Harry Hursty. Harry, I have to tell you, he comes in here, he's got an Indiana Jones hat, he's not your typical computer scientist. We literally fished him off a sailboat because he had founded a large portion of the European Internet. Very accomplished guy. He said when he came, I want to see how deep is the rabbit hole, really. He wanted to look at the voting machines. Within 24 hours, looking at the paper ballot voting machine, he said, I have found the Holy Grail. And I have to agree.
Now, we're not talking about touchscreen machines here. We're talking about the machines that you feed your paper ballot into. And we're not talking about the kind where you punch a hole in them. We're talking about the kind where you darken the little circle, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And what he found, picture this. You have something the size of a credit card. It goes into all these different voting machines. It gets passed around in various ways and places so that a lot of hands touch it.
Now, these are just like these PCM CIA flashcards or the flashcards that you use on a video, on a camera, on a photograph camera to store pictures and things. It's just basically a memory card, right?
It's a memory card. It's a specific type of memory card. It's an older-fashioned kind, but you can get them. And by changing, and by the way, you don't even need to know a whole lot, by simply rewriting and putting your own thing on that memory card and swapping it in, you own the election. And he was able to basically preload that card with a combination of positive and negative votes. So in other words, if you get negative 100 for this candidate and positive 100 for that, it's going to look like the same number of voters as actually showed up. You're not going to get any extra voters out of that. But it's going to artificially manipulate the votes for the candidates.
So in other words, if one candidate had 7,000 votes and the other had 9,000, now one has 6,900 and the other one has 9,100 or vice versa.
Right, right. So there's going to come out the right number of voters, and so it won't show up that way. And he was also able to manipulate the reports that come out of the machines themselves so that they say there's no votes on the card, even though there's votes preloaded on the card. And the problem with that is it's one-stop shopping. You swap in something the size of a credit card at any point along the process, and you take out and manipulate both the poll tape that comes out of the voting machine and the central tabulator in one step.
Wow.
Not only did he find this and prove it in Leon County, but Leon County, Florida. But this particular system is used in 30 counties in Florida, in 800 locations in the United States, and it counted a nearly over 25 million votes, more than 25% of the election in 2004.
Now, so you've got this little card that's similar to the flash memory cards that people have in their digital cameras. It's not the same, but it's very similar to that. You've got this little memory card, a little larger than about the size of a credit card, and you simply pop that into the optical scan machine, the device that is scanning the votes. Is this the sort of thing that a voter or somebody could do surreptitiously? I mean, you know, could I walk as I'm, you know, I fill out my ballot in the little booth, and then I walk over to the box where I'm going to feed my ballot into the box, and it's going to scan it. Could I, you know, if somebody distracted the voting poll workers or something, you know, the old grifter thing, could I just kind of reach around the back and pull a card out and pop my card in?
It would be difficult to do that. The greater risk is that one of the 10,000 election officials or techs or contractors that get their hands on it, or even polling place judges, might make that swap. One of the things that's very odd about these kinds of voting machines is that many counties send them home with poll workers before the election. So, for example, in San Diego County, they sent home 700 of these machines with the little cards in them.
You're kidding.
To people, and they kept them in their homes for 2 weeks. And all it
You're
really
kidding.
Took was one card to corrupt the system.
Now, Bev, I know that it is possible to have memory cards that are read-only rather than programmable. Why are they using programmable cards rather than read-only cards?
Well, they're putting votes on them.
I see. The card has to be able to read the votes.
Right.
So in other words, this is the card that after the machine has recorded all the votes, they're on this card. You pull the card out, and this is your record of the vote?
Right. This is the formal record, the official record of the vote, and it cranks out both the report from the polling place, and it goes into the central tabulator and creates that report.
So there's no way to make it secure.
Yes. If you infect this card, it's all over. There's only one way to catch it, and that is by counting all of the paper ballots, which is never done.
By hand?
By hand, which is virtually never done.
Amazing. Now, Bev, you know, a lot of folks, and I've written about you many times. I mean, you and I have been corresponding, working, I don't know what you want to call it, you know, collaborating. I don't want to put myself in your league. You've just done extraordinary work in this area. I've written about the work that you've been doing for years and followed it, and we've known each other for some time. And I talk about you on the radio. I get people who call up and they go, oh, that Bev, she's just a conspiracy theorist. She's just, you know, if you look at enough things, you're always going to find something flaky, and everybody, you know, there's always going to be somebody who wants to blow it out of the water. Is, you know, what's your response to these folks? Is there any validation of your research, or is this just Bev Harris running around saying, hey, look at what I found?
Well, isn't it funny? It seems that after a period of time has passed, indeed, the work that we've created has been validated, has been replicated. For example, the Dr. Thompson hack of the tabulator was a very similar approach, was actually written up by the CERT website, which is sponsored by the Homeland Security Department in the United States, specified the GEMS central tabulator hack as a national security risk.
This is Diebold's product.
Yes, this is. And we've just found out last week that Kenneth Blackwell commissioned a report which told him the same thing. He received the report on August 18th, 2004, before the election, and he withheld it from the public.
We have just about 2.5 minutes left. Dave in Eureka, California is on the line. He has a question for you. Dave, you're live with Bev Harris.
I do thank you both for the attention you give to this subject. It's so vital to this country, and the failure of main media to address it is just unthinkable. But my question is, when it does become abundantly clear, as it has to many of us, that this our elections have been rigged, I want to know what thought can we put into it, the recourse, what redress might the people have? I think we need to have a Pat Fitzgerald on this, a Patrick Fitzgerald. I think it's criminal to have done what they've done to these elections. And if not criminal, then to civil recourse, an injunction that says, these machines cannot be used. They're obviously unreliable.
Well, one of the first recourses we have is to get Washington, D.C. out of denial. That's begun in the GAO, the General Accounting Office, GAO report that was released just last week, which validated the Harry Hursty study and said, indeed, we do have security problems with these machines. That's one of the first things, because we're not going to get anywhere if people keep denying that there's a problem. And then we have to look at specific methods to mitigate the risks. We need to get all of the election officials out of denial and get them into a more positive mode of saying, okay, if there are risks, let's identify them and let's figure out how to solve them. Instead of putting up resistance and working in an adversarial way, we need to be working together. The first step on that is to get officials to get out of denial. And two things happened recently that help with that. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, put together an attack tree presentation in Washington, D.C. It was attended by about 200 people, including election officials. And for the first time, an honest dialogue was taking place about this. And the second thing being the GAO report, which validated these concerns and is saying we need to do some work.
This is important stuff. We only have about a minute left. Bev Harris, Dave's question presupposes or presumes that there isn't just a security hole here, but that somebody has exploited it, that somebody somewhere has hacked an election. Now, I know the only elected official to have ever hacked a Diebold voting machine live and on national television was Howard Dean, with you. I mean, you know, I tell Republicans this and their eyes bug out. Did you know that the chairman of the Democratic National Party hacked a voting machine, a Diebold machine, on national TV with Bev Harris? And they go, you're kidding! but really, in a more serious way, I mean, that was an experiment. Dave is saying, have crimes been committed, and if so, what do we do about it?
This is the $64,000 question, because it's very difficult to find out. We really need a special prosecutor, period, because we are having a real hard time getting people who have the backbone to actually consecrate and prosecute this.
Yeah, and that's therein lies the rub. They have to take it seriously first. You have to assume that they're, well, yeah, okay. Bev Harris, blackboxvoting.org, her website. Bev, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work. You are a great American hero, and I'm so pleased and proud to have you with us on the program.
Well, thank you so much, Tom.
It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The machines don't leave no paper trail. The billionaires don't want you to vote this year. We'll send you a message that's loud and clear that the votes can't be counted in your community. Why even register? Don't waste your energy. Don't go to the polls.
The billionaires, they really didn't vote. Didn't you, John? Wipe off. After all, it's just democracy. I got to tell you, this is my issue with this thing, and this is the core issue. The radical experiment that the founders of this country came up with was the idea that instead of the commons being owned by the warlord king, the theocratic popes or mullahs, or the rich, which is the three historic forms of government over most of 7,000 years of civilization. You either had kingdoms, you had theocracies, or you had feudalism, which is also known as rule by the rich, rather than having them own the commons. Remember old Robin Hood and that, you know, you couldn't go hunting in the king's forest. Those are his deer. Rather than having them own the commons, the founders of this country said, no, we're going to flip that upside down. And we're going to say that we own the commons. that we have the rights, that we delegate privileges to institutions when we create them, rather than the old model, the 7,000-year-old model, that these institutions held the privileges and they owned, or the rights, and they owned the commons, and they delegated to us privileges and the use of the commons. We're saying, no, the commons is us. The commons, we own the commons. And we have the rights to administer those commons. So the commons of our fresh air and our fresh water, and the commons that have to do with our public safety, the police department, the fire department, the army, the commons that have in every other country in the world except the United States, the commons of health care, the commons of transportation, of public transportation. We're gonna run a system so that our airlines work. We're gonna, in most countries, the railroads, in this country to some extent a little bit with Amtrak, the commons, our highways, our interstate highway system, our education system. These are all parts of the commons. And this radical idea of America, the radical idea of the founders of this country, was that we, the people, would control the commons. We would own the commons, and we would institute ourselves. Governments would be instituted among men, to paraphrase the founders, in order to administer those commons. Now, if the government is administering the commons and the government is answerable to us, then you could argue that the greatest of the commons is the government. After all, we own it. I mean, we own our national parks, we own our schools, we own our roads, we pay for all that stuff with our taxes. That's all the commons. We own that. But the government is administering it, so we own the government. That's the greatest of the commons, and yet there's one greater than that. How is it that we tell the government how we want our commons administered? How do we do that? We do that with our vote. And so, in a very real way, our vote is the most vital of the commons. It is the most critical of the commons. It is the most sacred of the commons, because it is that part of the commons of government by which all the other commons are administered. That's how we tell our elected representatives, representatives. We don't elect leaders in this country. We elect representatives to represent us. That's how we tell our elected representatives, this is how we'd like you administering the commons. This is what we would like you to do with the commons. This is how we want to make sure that our air is pure and that our water is drinkable and that our food is safe and that our drugs are safe and efficacious and that our kids are well educated and that our health care is taken care of and that our retirements are safe and secure and that our jobs are appropriate and that our monetary system functions and all the other things that are the parts of the commons, the way that we tell our government, this is how we want it done. The way that we tell our government, this is how we want to make sure everything is working, is through our vote. And as Thomas Paine said, when you take away a man's vote, you reduce him to tyranny. I mean, technically, you could say you reduce him to being a subject of tyranny. But the point is, the vote is the most sacred of all the commons. Now, George W. Bush has said, and the conservatives, the cons have been saying this, I mean, for time immemorial, you know, this idea of the commons, it's all very well and good, and the founders, you know, and the Rousseau and Locke and the Enlightenment thinkers and all those liberals from the 1600s and 1700s who founded this country. That was all well and good, but, you know, a lot of this common stuff, we can turn this over to private corporations. They can do it more efficiently. Let's have our national parks. Let's have the rest stands, you know, the restaurants and the food. Let's turn that over to a private company. Let's have our prisons be run by private corporations. Let's try to privatize our schools. And I would argue that these are all felonies, crimes against democracy, the privatization of the commons. But I would also argue that these are all relatively small crimes against democracy. They're all things that are readily undoable. They're all things that we, the people, by exercising our will through our vote, we can say, no, we're not going to let you do that. We actually want public schools. We want our kids to be able to have a good free education so that we can have social mobility in this country. But when you privatize my vote, when you hand my vote over to a private corporation that's not answerable to me, it's answerable to a board of directors. It's no longer answerable to we the people, to us voters. It's answerable exclusively to its officers, its CEO, its board of directors, and its stockholders. And it can claim things like trade secrets and in a phony way, in my opinion, Fourth Amendment privacy rights. When you hand my vote over to a corporation that says, oh, no, we have privacy, we don't have to tell you how you voted, then you have reduced me to tyranny, to paraphrase Tom Paine. And that is the true felony against democracy, my friends. That is the major felony against democracy, the privatization of the vote in America. And then allowing companies to profiteer off it on top of that, the ultimate felony against democracy. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
We voted on machines without a paper trail. Whoever brought us those touch screens ought to go to jail. No more hanging chads.
Please don't answer some questions.
No more democracy. What's lost is lost. We have been had, screwed so thoroughly.
Welcome back, my friends.
Oh, coup d'etat. Here we go again. Ohio and Florida, where cheaters go to win.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. Joyce McCloy is with us. She started ncvoter.net, as in North Carolina Vote Coalition, ncvoter.net. Joyce, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Very, very glad to have you with us. You argue that the election in North Carolina was a complete meltdown. What led you to this conclusion? That's a pretty strong statement.
I think another good word for it is fiasco, or Florida-like election nightmare.
Okay, we're talking the 2004 presidential election, right?
Right. We had one county lost 4,438 votes on a touchscreen voting machine. The votes were completely lost, and we never could find out who won the it affected a statewide election.
Hmm. And what was done about that?
We had to, I guess you'd call that the election that never ended. The state board tried to find a solution, and it looked like they would be asking everybody to come back and vote, have a whole new election across the state, and that would cost $3.5 million. But ultimately, one of the contestants for the race, the Commissioner of Agriculture, bowed out 3 months later after the election.
Wow.
That helped our state board to save face.
Yeah. So Joyce McCloy, how did these votes get lost?
The machine could only hold 3,005 votes, and evidently no one knew that. It was supposed to hold 10,000.
Wait. Excuse, pardon my interrupting you here, but the machine, this isn't like a piggy bank. These are computers, right?
Yes.
My computer can count higher than 3,000. You had a computer tabulating your vote that could only count up to 3,000?
Well, they were told it could hold 10,000 votes, which even that's ridiculous. But when it reached 3,005, it was letting people continue to vote, but it was no longer recording them. But what kind of dunderhead would program a machine to allow people to vote when the memory's full?
Well, that's a good question. Who was the dunderhead who programmed this machine?
Well, it's a Unelect voting machine. So it's the design of the machine. It's an incredibly poor design.
The machine was designed from the get-go to not allow more than 3,000 or respectively 10,000 votes, period?
Right.
Why?
Evidently, they didn't have very, probably maybe they didn't get any good high school students to come in and design the machines. I don't know. Anybody can make a
junior
voting machine.
Anybody, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Joyce. Continue.
Anybody could. We just never did know who won. We never did know. That went on
until... And you still don't know to this day.
In February, finally, the Britt Cobb, the Democratic contender, just bowed out.
Yeah,
because it was just too embarrassing for our predominantly Democrat Board of Elections officials to, have this in their face every day.
Yeah. Now, we're talking with Joyce McCloy with the North Carolina Vote Coalition, ncvoter.net. Joyce, do you have a background in voting machines, in electronics, in computers, or for that matter, in political activism?
Well, how about a background as working as a bank clerk? When I found out about paperless voting that it was going to spread all over my state, and I compared it to what we did in banking operations. I couldn't believe it.
And in many cases, it's the same companies that make the bank machines, the ATMs, and that make the voting machines.
But not the same divisions. I'm sure that Diebold's ATM division is a little bit more efficient than the voting division. But what we have here is Enron-style elections. You know, we have no accounting going on, and if there's a failure in the system, there's no way to recover.
Tell me about, Joyce, the other companies and the other machines that were having problems in North Carolina.
Well, and I don't want to leave Diebold out, so I'm going to get to them because they deserve some honorable mention in our state, in fact, quite a bit. But ES&S, in one of our largest counties, the central tabulator subtracted votes. Once it reached 32,000 votes, it just subtracted them. So they had to re-up them in chunks. You know, there were 22,000 votes missing on election night. Another county had the machine allowed 11,000 votes to be counted twice. Then we had our largest county, nearly 500,000 voters. Well, their machine had an extra 4,000 votes. These are all touchscreen or any kind of direct record machine. Extra votes, just, and they never did match up the records on that machine that had the extra 4,000 votes.
Well, it would seem that they would never have a means to. I mean, for that matter, it raises the question, Joyce, if these are electronic voting machines, touchscreen machines that don't leave a paper trail and don't have any record, how do you actually know that, you know, 20,000 votes went missing or 10,000 got added or whatever? How do you know that?
Well, you don't, but nobody's really questioned it until the past few years. Now, Gaston County uses Diebold, and I want to give them a special commendation for not uploading 14,000 votes for nearly a week. And that's when they had the Diebold technician on site. We're paying her $1,000 a day, and they still could not get those votes counted. 14,000 votes. So that was finally, you know, we didn't have correct totals on election night. November 2 was a disaster. We're told that electronic voting, that we have to have it because it's so fast and it's so accurate. But in North Carolina, it took 3 months and we never did know who won the Commissioner of Agriculture. It's not fast. It's not accurate. It takes weeks and weeks to get the results.
So this is not a rapid, efficient system, these electronic voting machines, as they're being advertised. At least that wasn't your experience in North Carolina.
Well, we have three counties that hand count ballots, and at least they got their results for Commissioner of Agriculture, whereas Carteret, with their high-tech touchscreen machines, never could figure out who won.
So Joyce McCloy with the North Carolina Vote Coalition, ncvoter.net, you work in a bank. You understand banking and computers and paper trails and things. You see this paperless voting coming to your state. How did you get involved in this issue?
Well, I tried to find some group to join or, you know, somebody that was doing something in our state, and nobody was doing anything. So I thought, oh, my God, you know, I know a tiny bit about this. I'll start something, and maybe somebody will take over. Well, no one took over, so here we are. We started warning our state board of elections nearly 2 years ago. You know, what are you going to do with all these paperless machines when they crash? And they just laughed at us and called us a bunch of conspiracy nuts and, you know, just totally were condescending towards us. And then we got the last, you know, after the election, I mean, it just proved us right.
Joyce, you're a great example of how citizens can and should get involved in the democratic process in involving themselves in America. Why is it that, I mean, these are huge errors that you found in North Carolina. Why is it that the average American is not familiar with this? Why hasn't 60 Minutes done a special on this? Why wasn't it the New York Times? I mean, has the national media been down knocking on your door?
I just don't know why they. It seems like they've ignored any kind of significant issue, and you know, all we've heard about are things like Britney Spears being pregnant, and you know, I haven't heard any really significant news on mainstream media for years. So maybe we're just one of the many things left out.
What efforts have you made to publicize what you've discovered, Joyce McCloy?
Well, we started out with, I started documenting, you know, instances of things happening in North Carolina, and then I just started sending it out to different people, and then other groups joined us. We developed a coalition of different groups, and, I mean, just about anybody who wanted to join. I do a lot of writing. If you don't have a dime, you can write an opinion piece. If you don't know how to do that, you can write a letter.
There you go.
When I first started out, I was scared to even write a letter to the editor. I didn't know how.
Yeah.
And so now I've been writing, you know, you just keep doing it. Just we use the kitchen sink method in North Carolina. We throw everything at the issue.
Uh-huh.
We do it all. You know, we've got a free internet email service. I have my website. It's very inexpensive.
Yeah.
We just, you know, we do whatever. Pick it outside your board of elections. That's always a good way to get some attention to the issue.
Well, I mean, that's how the revolution was started in the United States. You had mostly men who were out doing pamphlets and sticking, you know, nailing them on trees and buildings, and mostly women who would organize what were called committees of correspondents, who were writing letters to the editors of newspapers. And between the two of them, you know, they stirred up enough people that we got a revolution going on in the United States in 1776. It seems like, you know, the gender split may not be so much there anymore, but American citizens are becoming activists, and you're a great example of it. I think it's absolutely marvelous what you've done.
Well, we all just stick with it, and it just grows, you know, and eventually people will believe you after you've been proven right. It took a while, but this election totally proved us right, and they started to consider us as experts on the issue.
Joyce McCloy, what is North Carolina doing as a result of what you have documented?
Well, finally, we passed a law requiring voter-verified paper ballots and audit of the source code.
At the state level?
Yes. And it's not a perfect law. I mean, there are some election officials in our state that don't want verified voting. That is where our biggest resistance. Well, gee, I don't know for sure why, but why would somebody not want to make sure every vote's counted?
Well, that's the question I've been asking. I mean, for 2 years, I've been trying to get the Republicans have had this thing bottled up in the House, you know, Rush Holt's bill. For 2 years, I've been trying to get somebody to come on the air and tell me why. Nobody will.
Well, they can't get away with it unless the Democrats collude.
Yeah, well, there's that, too. Joyce McCloy, ncvoter.net, her website. Joyce, you are a true American hero. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for getting the word out.
Much appreciated. Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour.
Hurry, supplies are limited.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You can call for a recount, but it's going to fail. You can't recount the ballots without a paper trail.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In the place where being progressive never felt so good, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Brad Friedman is with us with BradBlog.com. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here again.
Great to have you here again. Brad, tell us about the Revolution campaign to divest in voting company stocks and your whistleblower reward.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we've done in the wake of all of this election nightmare that has ensued since November 2nd is I've set up an organization called VelvetRevolution.us, and we've tried to make it a clearinghouse for all of the reports, hundreds and thousands of reports, on what has gone wrong with our electoral system.
You mean just nationwide?
Nationwide, indeed. And as you know, there is more than enough to worry about. You'd think the media would be all over it, but it falls to folks like you and me and other citizens to take matters into our own hands. And indeed, the folks in Washington, Republican and Democrat, by and large, are doing nothing to fix the problem. So we've taken things into our own hands. We're trying to work around the politicians and the corporate mainstream media. And one of the things that we've done at VelvetRevolution.us is to put out rewards to encourage whistleblowers to come forward, share information with us that we then investigate, report on, share with the folks who need to know, whether it's the law enforcement or up in Congress, to let them know about what's going on.
Have any of these whistleblowers come forward yet?
In fact, they have. I've reported on a number of these at BradBlog.com, of course, including Clint Curtis, the software programmer down in Florida, who was asked allegedly to create vote rigging software. I've had other insiders from Diebold, one, in fact, that I've referred to as Deep Throat, since they're currently anonymous, and we will protect the identity of anyone who comes forward. the Deep Throat reported to us about the Homeland Security warning concerning Diebold machines. Put that information out there, and within a few days, don't know if it's directly related, but a few days later, Diebold stock dropped some 20%.
Now, hang on just a second. Let me get this straight.
Yep.
You're saying that the Department of Homeland Security itself issued a warning about Diebold's machines?
The United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, which is a branch of Homeland Security that reports on cyber security concerns, put out a warning prior to the election saying that Diebold machines had an undocumented backdoor, they could be hacked, and a single malicious user could, in fact, change the results of any Diebold election.
Right. And, in fact, didn't they report Bev Harris was the source of this information?
BlackBoxVoting.org? In fact, they did. It was BlackBoxVoting.org that discovered that information in the first place.
Right.
U.S. CERT put it out there prior to last year's election, and of course, nobody in the media picked it up.
I was the first one to report it a few weeks ago. U.S. CERT being the official government agency that's responsible for certifying voting machines?
No, they in fact warned folks about cyber concerns.
Oh, I see.
Machines that can be hacked.
This is the Homeland Security part.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Now, how has the media, the mainstream media in the United States, failed in their reporting on these voting issues, in your opinion, in your experience?
In every way possible. They have been delinquent in these matters. I mean, we're only talking about voting here, the very core of democracy. They put out, when you do see an article, it's put out, New York Times put out an article that said, conspiracy theories easily disproven, or something along that line.
Sure.
Now, that's in contradiction now to government reports, nonpartisan GAO reports that have come out and said, in fact, these machines are hackable. So the media has not been doing their job, whether it's laziness, whether there is some greater reason for this, but it's remarkable. After I reported on the Deep Throat story recently, a paper in Ohio contacted me about the story, and I took the opportunity to talk to the reporter about this lockdown, for example, that happened on election night in Warren County, where they kept out all witnesses from the counting. Warren County was the last county to come in with their totals that put George Bush over the top in Ohio. They locked down the counting room so nobody could come in. I mentioned this to the reporter and told the reporter that, in fact, the next day, when we checked with Homeland Security, they had no idea about any terror warning.
Right. Now, Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, that's one of the stories that actually made it into the mainstream media, I think. There's a couple, though, out of Ohio that never did. We have about a minute left. Can you summarize those?
Well, let's see. There was 4,000 votes that were cast for George W. Bush in Gahanna 1B precinct. Doesn't sound extraordinary, except that there was only 337 votes that night. So when these stories come out, and even the Warren County that barely was a blip on the screen, you would think when you go back and you find out that, in fact, Homeland Security never spoke to anyone in Ohio as they claimed, that the mainstream media would be out there trying to figure out who's telling the truth.
What about the failure to do an effective and accurate recount, a true random recount in Ohio?
Oh, yeah. The recount in Ohio was gamed from top to bottom. We had a whistleblower come forward, Cheryl Eaton, who explained that a voting machine company employee came in, actually removed a hard drive prior to the election, and did something to it and restored it, was then offering cheat sheets to counties so that they could, instead of randomly counting as they're supposed to by state law, they would specifically count counties that would make things match up. And now two elections officials have been indicted for doing exactly that.
Amazing. Brad Friedman, BradBlog.com. Brad, thanks a lot for the great reporting you're doing. Thanks for being on the program with us today.
Keep up the good work, Tom.
You too, Brad. Good talking to you. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the True People's Radio, the place where we get our talking points from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, and streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, White Rose Society, CRN Digital, and AirAmericaRadio.com, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Andrew Gumbel is the U.S. correspondent for The Independent, the newspaper, The Independent in London, and the author of Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System, a marvelous book. And Andrew is actually here with us in the studio. Andrew, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I think you're going to have to get a little closer to that mic, though, if we're going to, pardon me if that's okay. There we go. Andrew, were the problems in the 2000 election a wild deviation from the norm?
That's the way that they were characterized at the time. I think a lot of Americans felt that way. The thing that struck me at the time, and more especially since, when there have been all the problems with voting machines that you've been talking about all morning, is that there needed to be some kind of reassessment of the whole history of this, because clearly there's been a tremendous history of malfeasance and fraud and outright cheating going back really, you know, more or less to the dawn of the Republic. And I felt that in order to understand what was going on in the 2000 election and since, you really had to go back and understand the nature of that. Why was America such an anomalous country compared with other developed democracies around the world, which seemed to have cleaned up their act sometime in the late 19th century? How come this was a persistent problem, and how come it was rearing its head again now, so visibly after 2000?
Are we really and truly anomalous?
In a number of ways, yes, which has a lot to do with the development of democracy in the United States, the fact that it was actually out front of other countries in terms of expanding suffrage rights in the early 19th century, and then anomalously cut back at the end of the 19th century, which had to do with the progression of the Industrial Revolution. In most countries, the Industrial Revolution happened first. The industrial working class clamored for rights, including voting rights, and got them because the ruling class was afraid of insurrection. In the United States, it happened the other way around. They had the suffrage rights when the Industrial Revolution happened, and the industrial leaders were afraid that having that kind of political power would be a deeply unsettling factor in society for them, and so they set about deliberately disenfranchising as many people as they could, and that's a legacy that this country lives with to this day.
I was always of the impression that our Jim Crow laws, that race, that particularly in the South, that, you know, rigging elections, stuffing ballot boxes, making it hard for people to vote, poll taxes, all that stuff, you know, long tradition in America, but that it mostly had to do with issues of race or at the most probably issues of class or regionalism or local, you know, Boss Tweed, Mayor Daley, you know, local corrupt politicians, as opposed to something that was systemic and built into the fabric of the American voting system. Which is right? What is it?
Well, a lot of things happened systemically right from the very beginning. Slavery, as is well known, was a big blight on the whole drafting of the Constitution, and the way that it affected voting rights subsequently, because at the beginning voting rights were rather limited, is that you had a situation where congressional districts were carved up according to population that included slaves for the purposes of counting the weight of districts, but did not include slaves when it came to giving people votes, obviously.
With regard to the weight of districts, it counted
it was
three-fifths of the
three
slaves.
Three-fifths, right.
Yeah.
So that affected Congress. It affected the Senate because you had the South effectively got a bigger voice in the Senate than it would otherwise have done because of having two senators per state, regardless of size or population, and also with the Electoral College because that was based on the congressional district.
So how does that affect vote corruption?
What it did was it set an uneasy precedent of having a system that was skewed away from the black population, essentially, and that problem was never resolved. They tried to resolve it after the emancipation, but then the 14th and 15th Amendments proved to be flawed to the point where it was possible for the southern states to draw up new constitutions and effectively disenfranchise black voters to a large degree, if not totally. And at the same time, to come back to your question about class and race, There was a deliberate effort also to disenfranchise the industrial working class, not only in the South, white and black, but also in the North. And you talked about Boss Tweed and various other big city bosses. Ironically, Boss Tweed, for all his corruption and excess, his tenure in New York marked the absolute high point of voter participation in the city of New York.
Oh, really?
You know, and it's never recovered.
He paid people off well to vote for him, but
right.
He wanted to make sure that the votes were counted right.
Right. Well, not counted right, because they weren't counted right. But in terms of participation and in terms of retail politics and the way that we now understand it, of, you know, precinct captains doing services for people in those precincts, that's how New York was run by Boss Tweed.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about the movement against big city corruption, which happened at the same time as the Industrial Revolution, was they talked about corruption. But when they ended up enacting the reforms, the net effect was that the corruption remained as despicable as ever. And what changed was that voter participation plummeted from about 80% on average in elections in New York City to something more like 40%.
And what accounted for that change?
A number of things. One, very strikingly, and again, this is completely counterintuitive, was the introduction of a secret ballot. You would think that this would be an unimpeachable development, and indeed it was introduced in the same 20-30 year time frame
Yeah, I think a lot of Americans think the secret ballot was how it all started. But originally in the United States, people voted in public by raising their hand, did they not?
That's true. And then after that, it was the parties that ran the vote. So what would happen is the parties would issue the ballots. They were often color-coded, or they were different sizes according to different parties. So mm-hmm. if you were literate or semi-literate, it was very easy to know, this is my party, I'm going to vote with the orange ballot or the red ballot. What happened with the introduction of the secret ballot and the way it was misused in a number of places, let's emphasize that the secret ballot's a good idea, was that suddenly it was black print on white paper. In some cases, they removed all party affiliations. In some cases, they put the candidates in alphabetical order or in completely random order. So if you didn't know, if your party boss hadn't told you this is the person you need to go in and vote for, you were left clueless and you were effectively disenfranchised. And in fact, there are newspaper editorials written at the time in New York State and other places where people opined that, you know, they assumed that the whole point of the secret ballot was to disenfranchise the lower half of the socioeconomic pile.
And it worked out that way.
It did work out that way, absolutely.
It's interesting. We're talking with Andrew Gumbel. He is the U.S. correspondent for The Independent, the newspaper The Independent in London, and the author of the book Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. TomHartmann.com, our website, if you want to drop into the live chat room. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 1-866-440-THOM. We'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes as well for Andrew or for me or on this topic if you'd like. You have a chapter in your book, Levers, Punch Cards, and the Fallacy of the Technological Fix. What do you mean by the technological fix?
It's the notion that what is wrong with the system is that we don't have the right machine, and that if we only had the right machine, then everything else would be great. We saw this in Florida in 2000, where most of the public discussion on both sides of the aisle focused on the punch card machines, not on the really vicious, nasty political fight that was going on behind it. Clearly, the machines had an awful lot wrong with them. I'm certainly not defending them, but there was a counterexample in the 2000 election in the Senate race in Washington State between Slade Gorton, the outgoing Republican, and Maria Cantwell, his Democratic challenger. Same lousy machines, very close result. And what the two of them did was they got together, they established rules for how the recount would happen, first a machine recount and then a manual recount. They sat back for 3.5 weeks, and then they accepted the result without a murmur, which was a narrow victory for Maria Cantwell. The same thing could have happened in Florida, and the reason it didn't is because of the dirty politics, not because of the lousy machines.
Well, the reason it didn't was because George W. Bush sued Al Gore in the Supreme Court, Bush v. Gore, to stop the counting of the vote.
Right,
it?
Right.
I mean, that's the bottom line.
Right, although the Democrats didn't behave that well in Florida either. They should have called for a full statewide manual recount from the get-go, and they chose instead to focus on the counties where they thought they could retrieve the largest number of votes most quickly, which I personally think is a reason why Al Gore deserves to rot in a political hell. And, you know, as it turned out, when all the ballots became available for inspection by media consortia and they were examined, it turned out a statewide manual recount probably would have given the slimmest of margins to Al Gore. So it was a mistake.
Almost regardless,
right.
Hanging chads and shadow voters.
We're talking about 200 or 300 votes.
Right, and still Al Gore
statistically
won Florida.
Right, it's not a very sad. There are other reasons for thinking that Al Gore won Florida that are more persuasive in my view. But just to come back to the idea of the technological fix, this has been a historical constant. The first Levers machines were introduced in the late 19th century. And it really turned out that they were being tailored for the people who are running the elections, not the people who are voting. And in fact, in roughly half of the states where they were first introduced, they were thrown back out again because the voters hated them. With the introduction of the punch card machine in the 1960s, which was the first major computer-run voting machine, people were saying this is simpler than stirring coffee with a spoon. This is the miracle solution. This is going to produce flawless elections. And it rapidly turned out that the tabulation was unreliable. You know, we all know about the Chad problem, which emerged over time. And it also turned out you could fiddle with the pages inside the voting booth.
Well, in fact, I remember living in an area where punch cards were used. And the story that we read in the local paper was that people were just simply dropping a paperclip down into the envelope into which you inserted the card. If you just slid a paperclip down there, then when you slid the card in, the card would be an eighth of an inch off. And everybody who voted on that would be voting for somebody other than they thought they were voting for. So an entire voting area would be thrown off because of a paperclip.
Right.
And people were like going into districts where they knew were either Republican or Democrat and just throwing them off that way. It's just strange as stuff. So the technological fix comes back to bite us in the butt from time to time, it seems. We're talking with Andrew Gumbel. He's the U.S. correspondent for The Independent in London, author of Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Newspaper of The Independent, the author of Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. And, Andrew, do Americans really want to know the truth of our votes, or do we just want to have a system that looks good? And not just Americans. What about the people who are working at the precinct level, the people who are running the votes, the people who are you know, theoretically, I suppose, answerable to we the people to say, you know, well, here's how the election came out. Here's the results. You know, are they really interested in the results? Or are they really interested in being able to say, I did my job. You know, everything's fine. Don't worry.
Well, in terms of the American people, I think this is a country that has a lot of very high ideals about itself, obviously. And I think the people have largely and for a long time believed, when they've been told this is the greatest democracy on earth, that it's government of the people, for the people and by the people. And they've been very shocked to discover that it's not actually like that in reality, which is something that's come out more and more since 2000. In terms of the people who actually run elections, this is a world that has really not been opened up to public scrutiny really ever until the 2000 election really began to get people asking questions. Election offices were frequently places which were dumping grounds for sort of mediocre political hacks. There was never any weight given to having integrity and high professional standards in the system. And this is something, the legacy of which we're living with right now. And I think that the priority for people who run election offices, unfortunately, has been first and foremost to have the appearance of a well-run election, and secondly, to defend the integrity of the system. So that explains an awful lot of what went on with the punch cards, why they were allowed to persist even though they clearly didn't work, and there was a long history of them not working. And now with electronic voting machines, why county officials are so attracted to the idea of a machine which eliminates paper, which gets rid of recounts, and which basically eliminates second guessing of any kind. The election official thinks, here's this wonderful machine, I don't have to do that much work, and at the end of the day I can say everything is flawless. The phrase that many, many county officials I've heard use over and over when they're defending the DRE, the computer touchscreen machines, is, we have flawless elections in this county. We've had 22 flawless elections in this county with these machines. And it's plainly nonsense. And
Then how can they say it?
Because the material is not there to disprove them. And if they have control of what documentation there is in terms of the results of pre-election logic and accuracy testing, or zero tapes, which are the tapes that are supposed to show that there are no votes on the machine before the election begins, if they withhold those things and if the courts don't force them to produce them, then they can just say, trust me, you know, we have computers, the voters like the computers, the results are all clean and neat and seem to add up. Why are you complaining? You must be a conspiracy theorist.
So what's the alternative, Andrew Gumbel? Should we say no more machines in the United States? We're going to go back to paper? And by the way, what do you say to people who are blind or have other disabilities who seem to be one of the louder pro-voting machine groups right now? I realize they're funded in large part by the voting machine companies, or some of their non-profit advocacy groups are, not all of them. But, you know, how do you respond to them as well?
Right. Well, paper is a very attractive option in many ways, and a number of studies have been done that show it's the most reliable way to get an accurate count. In Britain, in Canada, and various other countries, they run elections almost completely on paper, and they get results relatively quickly.
Have they flirted with machines?
They have, yes. I mean, there have been various pilot tests in England, because in Britain they're worried about voter participation. They want to do everything they can to get people to vote. So they've experimented with phone voting, with internet voting, with voting by mail only. And they've really, as things stand, come back to the idea that the way things have been is basically the best system. But I don't think paper can work in the United States, because you have so many multi-race elections. You have a place like L.A. County, which is probably the biggest county in the United States, over 4 million registered voters, unbelievable numbers of precincts, different languages. And I really think the argument for having a machine is pretty much overwhelming. Then the question is, what kind of machine do you have? And the other really important question is, who is monitoring the machines to make sure that they meet basic standards? The United States is absolutely exceptional in the world in not having a central electoral commission or something similar to it that is the last word on what machines get used, what the rules are for running elections. In this country, basically, elections are run on the local level, which usually means county level. So you've got more than 4,000 different voting systems in the United States. And this is without any proper oversight. The only thing that oversees the standards of new machines is a voluntary body called the Election Center, which in turn farms out the federal certification process to private testing companies. The testing companies and the Election Center have a financial relationship. The voting machine companies and the Election Center have a financial relationship, and the voting machine companies and the testing labs have a financial relationship. So, and none of them are subject to any congressional oversight whatsoever. So the whole thing is a complete mess, and it's been shown time and again that even their claims of technological excellence have been clearly disproven by the way these machines have performed in the field.
So back to the original question. I mean, you say L.A. County, 4 million people, all these things, you have huge votes, but London is not a small town. And England doesn't use...
But you don't have multi-race elections. You're not voting for district attorney, for school board, for dog catcher, all these things. That's what makes the United States exceptional. I think there's actually a rather heretical question to be asked, which is, are there too many elections in this country? Is it, you know, given the level of disengagement in the political process, is it actually a form of manipulation of the electorate for specific partisan or corporate agendas?
Or should they be at different times?
At different times, there are certain issues, especially ballot initiatives in California and other places, on highly technical questions that the voters are not necessarily in a good position to be able to judge.
But then you end up with only 5% of the electorate voting, and they're the ones who are highly motivated, and in some cases spiffed, you know, or the results of carpet bombing advertising, and it's a mess. We'll continue with this. We're talking with Andrew Gumbel, the U.S. correspondent for The Independent in London. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're speaking with, in the studio, Andrew Gumbel. He's the U.S. correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent, published out of London, author of the book Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. Andrew, before we go any farther, do you have a website where people can find out more about what you're up to?
I wish I did. It's a work in progress, let's
okay.
put it that way.
All right, so nothing to plug there. Some of the folks in the chat room have tossed up a couple of interesting questions. You want to grab one? And there was something we were talking about during the break that seemed to be...
Well, one thing that I wanted to talk about a little more that came up in the chat room is the role of the political parties in this whole mess. And it's very tempting in the current context to see the Republican Party in the ascendant, all these reports of dodgy electoral practices which tend to be directed towards the Republicans, and thinking that it's a Republican Party problem. What I argue in the book is that it's really a problem arising from the corruption of the two-party system, the way the two parties a long time ago carved up the political landscape, excluding everybody else, slowly over time allowing more and more corporate money to influence the process, which is something that the founders and Jefferson in particular were very, very hotly concerned should not occur. And I think the important point to make is that stealing elections is not a question of one party being virtuous and the other one being villainous. It's a question of how high the stakes are, and it's also a question of opportunity. And if you look at Florida in 2000 or again in 2004 or Ohio in 2004, here you had a state that was substantially being controlled by one party. In this case, it was the Republicans, using every instrument at their disposal in order to make sure that the results came out the way that they wanted. You don't have to go back very far in time to find the Democrats behaving in exactly the same way. One shocking example, which actually galvanized the Republicans considerably, happened in 1984, a congressional race in Indiana, where the Democratic candidate came out ahead initially, but then after a recount, the Republican ended up the winner and was ratified as such by the state authorities in Indiana. And then the Congress, which was then controlled by the Democrats, hard to believe, but the Democrats did once control Congress, refused to seat the Republican, and they seated the Democrat instead, which is just an astonishing piece of, you know, anti-democratic with a small d behavior. And the Republicans, including Dick Cheney at the time, swore revenge, and they said, we're going to get these people for this. And I think that's...
We're going to get control of this election system
right here. And then, you know, over time they'd already started, but they started playing as dirty as they could and letting the Democrats know that the boot was now firmly on the other foot.
So, number one, you're suggesting this isn't a problem of the Republican Party, and yet I've been talking about this on the air for 2.5 years. I've been writing about it for at least that long, and I have no problem getting Democrats to come on this program and talk about it. I have not been able to get one single Republican to come on this program and say, this is the reason why Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert will not allow Rush Holt's bill to come to the floor for a vote.
Well, this is the reason why.
What's the deal?
The reason why is that something completely insane has happened, which is that this issue about the basic integrity of voting in this country, which likes to think of itself as the world's leading democracy, has been turned into a partisan dogfight. You have a situation where, because the Republicans are in the ascendant, most of the complaints are coming from the Democrats, and the reaction of elected Republicans, and let me underline elected, is to say this is Democrats complaining, this is nothing to do with democracy, they're conspiracy theorists, they're marginalized. And because the media has not picked up on this in any significant way, they've got away with that line of argument. Yeah. Just to give you one little example, in April of 2004, 6 months out from the presidential election, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights convened a meeting in Washington to talk about implementation of the Help America Vote Act, which, as it turned out, had missed all its deadlines, it was underfunded. The Election Assistance Commission, which had been set up, was gasping for breath because they didn't have people, they didn't have money, they had no way of carrying out their mandate. What happened? The Republican delegation walked out of the room in the first few minutes. They didn't even attend the meeting, and this is a completely insane state of affairs.
This is beneath us.
And I believe very firmly that there is a vast majority of voters in this country that want to have a system that has integrity, that includes everybody, that lives up to the ideals that everybody talks about constantly.
Yeah. Now,
and I think that, you know, it should be possible, and I address this to the activists on the Democratic side of the table, it's very tempting for them to demonize the Republicans. I think it's very important to separate Republican voters who care passionately about this issue, even though they're not being heard, and the Republican elected officials who see it in their interest to squash all debate on this.
Right. Let me point out our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8864, and you know, we'll be willing to take calls at this point now. And also, you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartmann.com if you'd like. We're in the studio with, us is Andrew Gumbel. He's the U.S. correspondent for The Independent, the newspaper The Independent, published out of London, author of Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. Andrew, in part, you just indicted the American two-party system, which is basically kind of a first-past-the-post, winner-take-all system. Other countries, including your own, have pieces of that, at least on an election-by-election basis. Australia and New Zealand have figured out a way to make the system, that system, more democratic without going to a parliamentary system, and that is instant runoff voting. It's happened in over 300 communities now, I believe, in the United States. But the founders really grappled with this. I mean, Madison was really struggling with this idea of if there is a third party that arises, if a third party arises, you could have, you know, two parties that each get 32% of the vote and one party that gets 34-35% of the vote, and, you know, basically a third of the electorate is deciding what two-thirds or 100% is going to have to deal with. And his solution, as he outlined in Federalist Number 10, was to beg people not to form political parties, what he called factions. You know, please don't form factions, because it was the only thing they could think of. I mean, it wasn't until the 1860s that John Stuart Mill first wrote about, although it had been in the air for at least a couple of decades before that, but that John Stuart Mill really laid out this whole idea proportional representation. And so I'm wondering, it seems to me that if the two-party system in your mind is the culprit here, or a major part of the culprit here, really there's only two ways around that. One is a constitutional convention to go to a proportional representation, which in my mind would be incredibly dangerous, because if we throw open a constitutional convention, given the amount of money in politics right now, we may end up with a constitution that resembles nothing democratic whatsoever. And the second being going to instant runoff voting, which in some ways may simplify things, but on the other hand may make things so complex that we almost have to have electronic voting machines, just to do all the instant tabulations and figuring and everything else. You know, how is this Australia and New Zealand, how are they handling this, for example, with the IRV? And what's your take on these two issues?
Well, let's just perhaps focus on the United States, because that's what I know best. I think that instant runoff voting is a very good idea if you have the right machines, absolutely. The other thing to be said is that you can address the most obvious corruptions in the system first before you start worrying about changing the entire architecture of the American political system. The most obvious point to start is the gerrymandering of congressional districts. You have a situation where in a number of states, meaningful electoral competition has been eliminated. And it's been eliminated for the convenience of the Republicans and the Democrats. To take your quick example, the last round of redistricting in California, so locked in the power structure that at the last election there were 153 congressional and legislative races last November, not a single one had a change of party hands. And that's a really shocking state of affairs. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger has talked about this, and I think he's absolutely right in his analysis of the problem.
Although his solution
is a whole other thing. Let's not get into that for right now. And the reason that happened was because the Democrats and the Republicans did a deal. The Democrats wanted to have a built-in majority in the California legislature, and the Republicans wanted to make sure they didn't lose any congressional seats in California so they would hold on to the majority in Congress in Washington. This is a thieves' bargain between two bunches of thieves, and that's the way the two parties have behaved in regard to the integrity of the democratic system in the United States for 100 years, and that needs to be exposed.
Yeah, and my rant on that is that part of the solution is for us to get involved in those – get in with the thieves, to get involved in the political party. Until Americans start participating in the parties, I mean, average people start showing up at the county level, start showing up at the regular level and saying, hey, we're part of this too. It's not just the smoke-filled rooms and the guys with the cigars. We're not going to see anything.
Right. Engagement is crucial, but so is also voter education. And one of the things that makes the United States anomalous is that there is no equal unpaid access to the media for all candidates in electoral races. In most other countries, that's true for third parties, fourth parties, fifth parties. If you allowed people into the room, as happened exceptionally during the California recall election, when they had six of the candidates talking around, sitting around and talking, you could extend the limits of political discussion.
But then as long as you still have first past for the post winner take all elections, you end up with the situation where in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
You know, right. But again, one problem at a time. Let's get the political debate going again.
Yeah, okay, I don't disagree with you. Wayne in Seattle's on the line. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm sorry I haven't read your book yet, but I assume you're familiar with the work of Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward.
Very much so. They wrote a great book called Why Americans Don't Vote and Why Politicians Like It That Way, something like that.
Yeah.
It's a great book.
They argue also that both parties seek to win by suppressing the votes of the other party, which brings the whole voter turnout down overall, and that's why we have so much negative advertising, et cetera. But recently, in Washington State, we had a governor's election where it was very close, and they played it up as a bitter fight between the two candidates. But then they went off in a room, the two candidates, the Secretary of State, all the election officials of the three counties that used electronic machines, and they all wrote a little agreement that they didn't need to recount electronic ballots during a manual, statewide manual recount.
Well, they didn't have the ability to do it, did they, Wayne? I mean, how can you recount electrons on a silicon chip?
Well, didn't they have the same exact situation as Florida, where the Democrats could have said, we have unequal protection here based on the fact that all votes aren't being recounted?
No, because in Florida they had the punch cards. They had actually a physical paper trail.
But they were recounting them in different ways, and that was their lawsuit.
Interesting one. We'll get Andrew's take on that right after this. Wayne, thanks for the call and raising the issue. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave him the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya.
Oh, you did so good, George.
He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. While soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared.
Whoops.
Gave him the old, never yet devil speak. Yes, with folks so swindled him. No one could hear the truth above the roar. And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled them, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
And welcome back, my friends. 51 minutes past the hour, 9 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman radio program. Andrew Gumbel's in the studio with us. He's the U.S. correspondent for the Independent of London and author of Steal This Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. And Andrew, we had a caller from Seattle. You wanted to get into your response to him a little bit.
Right, he was asking about the Gregoire Rossi governor's race last November that came right down to the wire, and it's an absolute classic textbook case of how the two parties behave in a tight race. That while Dino Rossi, the Republican, was ahead for the first couple of weeks after the election, he was saying, the election's over, let's close it down, and Christine Gregoire, his opponent, was saying, no, we have to count every vote, we have to keep going. Suddenly the tables were flipped and Gregoire was ahead, and the arguments flipped as well. If it hadn't been so serious, it would have been actually quite funny. There was then a lawsuit by the Rossi people afterwards, and they were focusing very much on King County, which is the county where Seattle is, and the allegation that a number of votes had gone astray, had been mishandled, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing really went nowhere for a very important reason, which is that there are other counties in Washington State, and evidence began to emerge that the Republicans may have benefited from some slightly dodgy counting in other counties. And it was the absolute classic position of both parties through history in these situations.
Both parties got a sudden moment of, uh-oh.
Right. Which is, you know, when push comes to shove, we're not going to contest this too vigorously. What I say in the book is, you know, the attitude is on the one hand, you know, they're probably cheating, so we'll cheat too. That certainly is a common phenomenon. And in this case, the other reflex is, you know, we won't say anything about what they've done because that'll only encourage them to rat on us in return. And I think there was an understanding that this was, you know, a form of warfare that could only do both sides great harm, which I think is why Christine Gregoire is now the uncontested governor of Washington State. But I certainly, from the evidence I've seen, wouldn't put my hand on my heart and say she won. I mean, it was a toss-up.
But on the other hand, you can't say she didn't.
Right, exactly.
There you go. Paul in Marquette, Michigan. You're live and on the air with Andrew Gumbel and me. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, first of all, I want to say on December 7th, 2004, the parties in Washington State agreed to a procedure. They realized there was no meaningful recount, so they just said, well, I'll just re-add the machine totals and that'll be good enough. So that's why no issues were ever raised, or one of the reasons. But I think what was really important about the discussion between yourself and Mr. Gumbel is this notion of it becoming a partisan issue. I think it's important to recognize that it has to be a partisan issue, and yet we still have to talk about it. The reason it must be partisan is because the winners are never going to question the result of the election. It's only the losers.
In other words, you have to have an adversarial system for there to be any any transparency ultimately, because without an adversary, it's all going to be, well, let's keep this under the table.
Right, and winners basically usually don't question why they've won. I mean, look at it this way, and then I've been a person who's studied some election results, and first they'll say, there's no evidence to support what you're saying. Then you get some evidence, and then they'll say, well, it's not enough to change the result. And let's say you find enough evidence to change the result. Well, now you're partisan, and it's sour grapes, and you need to be quiet.
Yeah, and get over it. It's over. It happened last month. It happened last year. You know, why is Al Gore whining now that we've done the complete vote count and discovered that he actually won? But still, you know, it's been a year and 9/11 has happened, and he should just go away, right?
There's two ways to get around that I've found, and one is to always focus on the future, because if you focus on the future instead of the past, nobody knows who's going to be the majority party, the minority party, and so people tend not to, you know which horse to root for, and so they tend to be more fair about it.
Right.
Another possibility is, if you're talking about the past, to just leave out the names of the parties and the names of the candidates. And I've done that with very mixed political audiences, and everybody was uniformly shocked, really, at what's going on. But as soon as you say which party you're from, then half of the people know you're nuts. And they're not going to listen to you.
There you go. That's when it becomes the partisan issue. All right. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Money in politics, Andrew. Can you speak to that issue?
Well, certainly that's been a big feature. If we just talk about the voting system, that's been a huge feature since the 2000 election, that the system has been awash with money, or the promise of money from the federal government through the Help America Vote Act, which promised almost $4 billion. And I think that accounts for the rush to buy these very expensive, overpriced, incidentally, and underperforming computer systems. If the money hadn't been quite so readily available, there might have been a little more thinking about how to spend it. And I think this issue is going to continue to haunt people, first of all, because they bought lousy machines, which are going to need replacing, and secondly, because the maintenance costs on these machines is absolutely astronomical in terms of adding patches, getting those patches certified, in terms of basic maintenance, in terms of training of personnel. With the touchscreen computer voting machines in particular, those costs are absolutely astronomical. So that's good. The money was there. We'll see if it still is. The federal government is in a phase of trying to cut everything it can because its commitments are getting bigger and bigger. In a more general sense, obviously, money has corrupted the political system. And you talked about this earlier in the last hour, what the founders intended about the commons and about making sure that what is public remains in public hands. I would add a little gloss to that and just say, to me, the definition of democracy is dividing political and economic power. And what we're seeing now, and we're seeing it in elections and everywhere else, is that the political and economic spheres are interfering with each other. You've got way too much corporate influence over the political system, and that is going directly against the public interest, including the public interest in elections.
It's not serving democracy. It's not serving us. It's
Absolutely.
Something we've got to do something about. There's a consensus, if nothing else. We all have to wake up. We all have to be aware of this. We need to wake up more people. I mean, that's the bottom line. Spread the word. Andrew Gumbel, get his book, Steal His Vote, A History of America's Dysfunctional Electoral System. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.